Didon Kimathi is a long time activist in Los Angeles, especially in the black community. A well-known Pan-Africanist. And I am sure that listening to people like him this evening is going to be very enlightening for us. Another of our guests for this forum is a former LAPD detective who now runs an organization called From the Wilderness. Those who remember the community meeting in which the director of the CIA visited the black community, one of the men who raised the most crucial issue that really showed the nature of the crime being committed by the CIA on the question of drug was Micropod. I now invite Micropod to this forum. Our next guest is the lead attorney in one of the class action lawsuits against the CIA in the matter of the CIA's involvement in the importation of drugs into the communities of color. I'm speaking of Bill Sipage.
Where are you, Bill?
Where are you, Bill?
Bill
Sipage. All right, I'm sure he's somewhere around this auditorium. Very importantly, I also want to recognize and invite him to this side of the auditorium, a former DEA agent who has developed a very formidable body of information on this great crime against humanity, Sully Castile. In the course of this program, I will be recognizing other participants who are playing very important role in this matter, but may not be one of our major speakers here this evening, and some time will be devoted to ensure that we are able to hear from them. And the first on that list, after the presentations from this side of the auditorium, will be Donna Warren. We are not going to wait for Bill. I am sure he will show up sometime in the course of this program. I will now invite Brother Didon Kimathi to lead this discussion on the issue of crack and the CIA. Brother Didon Kimathi.
Revolutionary greetings on behalf of the Crack the CIA Coalition, in which I co-chair, and also on behalf of the All African People's Revolutionary Party, the Pan-African Movement, and other progressive forces. Especially, we want to salute D2K, Dan, Shadow Convention, People's Convention, and Anarchist Convention, all coming together to expose the Democratic Party and its collusion with the system of the domination of capital over labor, profits over humanity, crass materialism over spirituality, materialism, crass materialism over Mother Earth. So for all the forces in town, both here as well as at the Convergence Center, at the Patriotic Hall, and other venues, including Belmont High School, we want to give a revolutionary greetings. And we're so enthused that this generation of young folks, students, the unemployed, have risen in the spirits of some of our previous activists in the 60s and 70s and taken to the streets to expose the contradictions between the ruling classes and the masses of humanity who seek a world based on human values and spiritual values, not profits, war, and crass materialism. So we'd like to give a round of applause to all the protesters and demonstrators in town to raise hell with the Democratic Party.
Yes.
What I'd like to do is play this, I'm a kind of an OG, but I have a lot of respect for revolutionary youth culture. So I'd like to play a cut from a group called Dead Prez as an intro, okay?
Thank you. honor, but I'm told that in places like in the Arctic, where indigenous people sometimes might hunt a wolf, they'll take a Japanese blade and they'll put blood on the blade and they'll melt the ice and stick the handle in the ice so that only the blade is protruding, and that a wolf will smell the blood and wants to eat, and it'll come and lick the blade trying to eat. And what happens is when the wolf licks the blade, of course, he cuts his tongue and he bleeds. And he thinks he's really having a good time. He drinks and he licks, and of course he's drinking his own blood and he kills himself. That's what the imperialists did to us with Trump pain. You got these young brothers out there thinking that they're getting something, that they're going to make a living, they're getting something, they can buy a car like the white people have cars. Why can't I have a car? They get something that they can get a piece of gold. The white people have gold. Why can't I have gold? They're getting something to get a house. The white people have a house. Why can't I have a house? And they actually think that it's something that's bringing resources to them, but they're killing themselves just like the wolf who's licking the blade, and they're slowly dying without knowing. That's what's happening to the community. You with me on that? That's exactly and precisely what happens to the community. And instead of blaming the hunter who put the damn handles and the blade in the ice for the wolf, that what happens is the wolf gets blamed for trying to live. That's what happens in our community. You don't blame the person, the victim, you blame the oppressor. Imperialism, white power is the enemy. Was the enemy when it first came to Africa, snatched up the first African brothers here against our will, is the enemy today.
Quickly go over it. In Alaska, the Inuit, what they call the Eskimos, but Native people, they call themselves Inuit, they have a practice where they'll take a knife and put it in the ice, and they'll put blood on the blade of the knife, have the handle in the ice, and let it freeze up. And wolves, when they smell the blood, they come after the knife, and they start licking the knife because there's blood on it. Because, you know, wolves like blood and raw meat. And as they lick the blade, it cuts their tongue. But they're in such a frenzy, you know, the endorphins kicking in the wolf's mind. They're in such a frenzy with the blood. They keep licking, cutting their tongue, cutting their mouth. They actually kill themselves in this frenzy over the knife that has the blood. The parallel is being drawn to crack cocaine. I am a plaintiff. I used to use free base crack, especially when it was kind of a cocaine, especially in the 50s and 60s. It was an entertainment, upper middle class, white high, powder cocaine. If you were very familiar with Silver Messenger Service, Canned Heat, you know, the nouveau riche rock artists, that was a drug of choice, cocaine, you know. As it moved, films like Superfly in particular kind of introduced it culturally into the African community. And it was in the middle class in Baldwin Hills or Dera Heights that was using cocaine because it cost, at that time, $100 for a gram. With a gram, you would get, put in a little bottle, mix it with baking soda, and heat it. And you would heat it until to separate the alkaloids and you get the little rock. Then you would smoke the rock. It was very expensive in those days. It was called freebasing. Okay? Because of the CIA, and these experts will talk about that, flooded the communities with cocaine, the cost went down from like $100 for a rock to $5 and $10 for a rock. It was really a genius marketing method. I think Mike Rupin and Sully would talk about that. But it was actually the upper middle class European community, white community, and the upper middle class African community that made freebasing or smoking crack cocaine popular. Then it kind of went down in price and it got spread from the upper class. Because many times what happens with the upper class is emulated or mimicked by the working class, by the unemployed as being trendy. So in this particular song by a group called Dead Prez, they just talk about how the frenzy, because if you ever smoke, those who have had experience with cocaine, I've never had experience with heroin or whatever, but as soon as you take one hit, you do whatever you can to get another hit, another hit, another hit, even though it's self-destructive. I think we have seen, and I know we all have stories of people in our lives, of people we know, who self-destruct over something that the high is good for 2 or 3 minutes, but it destroys your lifestyle. So that was kind of like the message there, and I kind of bring that forward because there is a strong resistance movement, especially among young people, to what they saw their parents and the older generations went through with cocaine. And I kind of like to give a historical perspective to start off with. I have an article here from the Monthly Review. And this is a statement. It is by John Neusinger. It is a little known fact that during the reign of Queen Victoria in the 1830s, the British capitalist state, the British Empire, was the largest drug pusher the world has ever seen. The smuggling of opium into China was by the 1830s a source of huge profits. It played a critical role in the financing of British rule in India and was the underpinning of British trade throughout the East, as well as finance the British military expeditions throughout the world. This is one of those little historical facts that are often overlooked. And people remember Empress Dowager, how she was kind of portrayed as an evil, villainous woman. The reason why was she led the opium wars to throw the British opium dealers out of China. And one of the whole bases for the rise of the Chinese Communist Party under Mao Zedong was the legacy of what imperialism had done to the people of China by mandating that opium be used by the people of China. So there's an historical precedence in drugs being used as chemical warfare, not only to downpress the people of an oppressed country, but also to maximize profits. Another article that comes from The Politics of Drugs, Who Suffers, Who Deals, Who Profits. After the inner city rebellions in the 1960s, and you know, when the Prince of Peace, Dr. Martin Luther King, crossed over to the ancestor world, 103 urban areas went up in rebellion as a testimonial to the lack of, for lack of a better word, the lack of success of his efforts through the nonviolent movement to bring equality, justice, and elimination of racism to African people in America. That sparked the rise of the Black Power Movement, the Black Panther Party, and so many movements, because Dr. King died trying to bring justice and it failed. They said after the inner city rebellions in the 1960s, there was a tremendous increase of heroin and barbiturates flowing into the oppressed communities, which was of no concern to the Nixon administration until drug addiction started to spread into the white middle-class neighborhood. And any of you have read the biography of J. Edgar Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover, until his death, refused to acknowledge that there was a mafia in the United States, refused to acknowledge that organized crime, together with the CIA, was bringing drugs in the community. And the reason why is the mafia was white mailing J. Edgar Hoover behind his transvestite homosexual practices. And they used that to shut him up. That's why the mafia was able, in conjunction with the CIA. And Alfred McCoy has a book called The Politics of Heroin. Excellent book, a PhD thesis, that talks about the role of the CIA and the mafia and the deals that were made, where the mafia was given green light to bring heroin in as long as the mafia would stop the organization of socialist and progressive trade unions along the coast in New York in particular. So there's a whole tradition here. I actually have a whole presentation to give, but we have such excellent speakers, I'm going to cut it short because time is short, okay? But what I'd like to do is hit a couple points. The number one, there's a historical legacy of drugs being used against people of color. And significantly, we have data here to show that there are more drug addicts, crack addicts, in the European or white community than in the African community. Not in a ratio proportion, but overall in terms of gross number. So one of my concerns is that the media, in terms of psychological operations, has always portrayed crack equals black. Black equals crack. If I say crack to you, you've been programmed subliminally and sublimely to think of a young brother. But objective statistics, empirical statistics from the FBI, shows that there are more white crack users than black crack users, or African crack users. So this question of stopping the flow of drugs is not something that's just unique to the African community or to the Native American Latino community. It's something we all need to unite upon, although they're trying to portray it as a black thing so the white middle class and working class and unemployed won't join us in forming movements to stop the flow of cocaine and to smash the CIA. It's a game, once again, to divide and conquer. Well, crack is a black thing, so white folks, y'all don't get involved with those kind of movements. So I want to put that out there. There's one point that's very important. Statistically, and it's really important because, you know, there's a whole game of divide and conquer, and they play a lot of, you know, things along that line. Statistically, we know first-time offenders charged with the same crime, young African youth, are six times more likely to be locked up as white youth. Six times more likely. Though whites and blacks use drugs at the same rate, nearly two-thirds of those convicted are black. We use drugs at the same rate, but two-thirds of those convicted are black. Between 1985 and 1995, the rate of Latino, Native American incarceration nationwide, more than tripled. Latinos are the largest growing group of imprisoned so-called American citizens today. It's another phenomenon that the media doesn't address. They always talk about black, 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 black.
but our Native American, our Latino brethren and sisters are the fastest growing incarceration rates. So these are the kind of things we need to put out there boldly to combat the media distortions of the facts so we can form the kind of alliance and coalitions to roll back the CIA and the drugs coming in our community. Though in California, Africans are 7% of the population, we make up 38% of all those sent to adult prisons. A lot of statistics like this are available. We can make them available to you. In terms of the media, if you ever notice, and we've been doing some studies and observation, that in terms of popular television and in terms of popular films, it's always the glorification of the drug dealer. Yet the media, especially films that are geared to the African and to the youth community, never really focus on the drug user or the drug addict. And so many films about South Central, Boys in the Hood, New Jack City, and so forth, they're always glamorifying the dope dealer, the drug dealer, the cars, the ladies, the posses, the weapons, the respect. But there are very few drama films, you know, of the Ice Cube and the Hudson Brothers character that talks about the damage it does to the drug addict. And we see this as part of an actual conspiracy coming out of Hollywood as part and parcel of the prison industrial complex that wants to encourage our young people to be involved with the drug trade. Groups like Public Enemy, Dead Prez, KRS, can never get radio play on primetime KBET or on KPWR, which are the primary hip-hop stations. But artists that promote drug use get played all the time on local radio in Los Angeles. Why is it that conscious artists can't get prime airtime because their music is too ethnic or too rebellious or too angry, but those talking about slinging drugs, banging, women or B's and H get primetime radio play on The Beat and on Power. Even The Salt on the Rastafarian movement. The Salt, where in Los Angeles, is easier to find a rock than a marijuana joint. You know, you go to Venice Beach right now, and you go down on Broadway, San Juan, go on Ocean Walk, I can find, you know, cocaine, rocks all day long. You try to find a marijuana cigarette, you can't find a joint. And I've never heard of anybody dying from smoking a joint. Maybe I'm wrong, but I've never heard of nobody dying from smoking a joint. And I believe in the legalization of marijuana, by the way, obviously. So, you want to make that point also. A number of studies have been done. They talk about how even within, and actually a study was done by University of Washington sociologists that found a consistent bias by probation officers in their written report on young black and white offenders. And they actually did a control experiments. They got two kids, one African, one European, from the same background, same offense, same age, no prior convictions. Black kids were described routinely as having bad character flaws, a bad attitude, bad mannerism, incorrigible, while the white kids were portrayed as victims of negative environment, exposure to some family conflicts, or being around bad company. We can look at Columbine, you know, the Columbine massacre that occurred in Littleton, in Colorado. They talked about, well, to rationalize the children committing the massacre, they talked about what they called the nerd factor, the jock factor. They watched too many video games. They were alienated. Their parents did not give them love. So somehow or other, when European youth are in the probation or in the judicial system, they come up with sociological reasons to rationale, to give them probation, to give them psychological therapy. Whereas when it comes to African youth with the same identical backgrounds, they're incorrigible. I mean, you say incorrigible, what are you saying? There's no hope for them. You got to lock them down because they cannot be rehabilitated. No matter what kind of psychological training or therapy they receive, they cannot be affected. So these are some of the examples just of racism within the question of cocaine and prosecution. And of course, we could talk about the prison industrial complex, the California Correction Officers Union, which is the major contributor to the governor's election, which is the major lobby, the largest lobbying organization in the United States today. Also in the stock market, the fastest growth stock industry, it has to do with securities. And the statistic shows that for every one inmate put into prison, the cost of building that prison for one inmate is $145,000 per inmate, and then $32,000 per year to sustain that inmate. That means from our tax dollars, $145,000 is coming from our pockets and going into the hands of private corporations, multinational corporations, to build the institution. And $32,000 per year comes out of our tax dollars to go and basically provide services to that inmate, food, clothing, shelter, telephones, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So basically, we're talking about $170,000 first WAP and $32,000 the second year and beyond coming out of our tax dollars going into the prison industrial complex, making the rich richer. while programs like education, music programs, sports programs in our communities are radically declining. In terms of solutions, we say power begins with conception, and I'll probably end this presentation giving some ideas we've put together collectively as Crack the CIA Coalition. I also maybe like to start and just state the demands of the coalition. The coalition's been around about 6 years. We have a number of people in the room, Donna, just a lot of activists in the room that have worked with the coalition, Maria, Brother Rudy, who have worked with the coalition. But our demands are very simple. Number one, we demand full disclosure of the CIA of all activities involved with drugs. Number two, we demand a full dismantling of the CIA. Number three, community control of all drug rehab programs. We want the community to control it as opposed to private sector corporations and bureaucracies. We want reparations to the affected communities. We want the repeal of mandatory minimum sentencing. We want the end to sentence disparity between powder and crack cocaine. We want to end the phony drug war that has the United States deeply involved. I'm sure Michael is going to mention it. The United States deep involved in Colombia today under the pretext of the so-called drug war. We want full support for the gang truce because we understand that the rise and the militarization and the violence of the gangs can be directly attributed to the CIA bringing drugs into South Central, providing easy access to weapons, as well as the runaway employers like Goodyear and Firestone, creating massive unemployment. And the cocaine coming in being, in fact, the employer of the unemployed because of the lack of full employment in our communities. And we want to end the media cover, especially LA Times, Washington Times, and New York Times, on constantly evolving and breaking stories, constantly documenting the role of the CIA and bringing drugs in our community. So that's kind of like a little overview of where we stand as the Crack the CIA Coalition. And I would like, at this point now, to bring up Mike Rupert, who I've spoken with for many programs throughout the country. I come from a Black Panther Party tradition, and I always say this, and Mike's gonna upset, but I gotta say this all the time, because I gotta make it very clear that I have no respect for any police or pigs, as we call them. But Mike has turned his energy against the police department, against the CIA, and has joined humanity in terms of providing research, facts, and helping us organize a movement against the CIA. So this is one of the few pigs or ex-pigs that I have the highest respect for. And Mike is just very, very consistent, very, very militant about his information about the cause.
Thank you, Didon. Well, there aren't a lot of us here, but maybe there's enough. And from what we have here, we can take it someplace else. Let me start by asking a question. Just shout out your answers. Somebody name for me the four states in the United States that are responsible for most of the importation of illegal drugs. Through what four states do they come? Texas, Florida, California, New York. Texas, California, Florida, and New York. DEA, Department of Justice, estimate that around 70-plus percent of all illegal smuggled drugs come in through those four states. $250 billion, $250 billion, every year. This is from University of Ottawa Economics Department, my research, a lot of other good research, is laundered through the American economy, meaning that drug money is moved through American financial institutions, businesses, stock purchases, to make that money legal and usable. Through what four states is most of that $250 billion laundered? Go ahead, shout it out. California, Texas, New York, Florida, the same four states. From what four states do 80% of all presidential campaign contributions come? Texas, California, Florida, and New York. Who governs Texas and Florida? The Bushes. Why does Hillary want New York? Could it be? These are some of the things that we begin to put in perspective when I begin to tell you a little bit about how the hows and the whys that the Central Intelligence Agency has been dealing drugs for more than 50 years, since even before it was the CIA. Now let me tell you something about the Central Intelligence Agency. The man who wrote the National Security Act of 1947 that created the CIA, his name was Clark Clifford. Who can tell me what Clark Clifford did for a living? He was a banker, Wall Street banker and a lawyer. He brought us BCCI, the drug bank that bought American banks in the 1990s. He wrote the Act in 47 creating CIA. Now, who designed the CIA and told Clark Clifford how to write the Act? It was two guys named John Foster and Alan Dulles. What did they do for a living? They were lawyers in the Wall Street law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, the largest law firm on Wall Street. William Casey, who was Ronald Reagan's director of Central Intelligence, what did he do for a living? He was a lawyer, and he was a stockbroker, and under Richard Nixon, he was chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. The CIA is an agency that has, for its entire existence, acted for and on behalf of Wall Street. When you begin to comprehend that, you begin to understand why, out of a half a trillion dollars a year, as Le Monde, the wonderful publication from Paris, puts it so eloquently, we have evolved into a situation where the wars of this century will be for the control of illegal money. Who can control the profits of a trillion-dollar crime industry and a half a trillion dollars a year in illegal drug money? There are a great many ways I can explain that to you. Now, let me say, while I have your attention, that I'm the publisher and editor of From the Wilderness. It's a newsletter we have at the back table. We're now read by 12 members of Congress. We just picked up Slade Gorton and Patrick Leahy, who are both opponents of U.S. involvement in Colombia, the intelligence committees of both houses, and professors at 10 universities. We also have a fabulous book up there at the table from a very dear friend of mine, Celerino Castillo, a true American hero, who stood at Ilopango Airfield in El Salvador and watched CIA personnel orchestrate plane loads of cocaine flying into the U.S., personally confronted George Bush, only to be told, leave it alone, it's a White House operation. There are only a few copies of Sully's book, and we have them back at the table, and they're autographed. I encourage you to support him, because half of every sale goes directly to keep him in house and home. Now that I've done the commercial, I love you too. I want to talk a little bit about the economy, because when you understand the role of CIA in drugs and why it happens, you will begin to understand how the whole system fits together. I shared in a panel earlier today. Now, this is very hard to see, but we don't have an overhead. But if I were to tell you, and almost everybody here is from L.A., that this is the Santa Monica Freeway right here, and this is the Harbor Freeway right here, you would say that this mass of black dots is South Central Los Angeles. Wouldn't you agree with me that that's South Central Los Angeles? Now, what if I told you that this map, prepared by a former Assistant Secretary of Housing, each one of those dots represents the foreclosure of a single-family home loan in South Central Los Angeles that defaulted between 1982 and 1990. There were many casualties of the crack cocaine epidemic, but economically speaking, the rich people have always had an idea that it's always better to use the poor people's money to vanquish them than spend their own. So they could bring the cocaine into Los Angeles and take all the money from the sales of cocaine, drive the property values down to the point where people who had $120,000 mortgages could no longer keep the payments because the neighborhood had turned into a war zone, the children were in jail, dead, or in the hospital, and they couldn't sell the house for what they owed on it, so they walked away. And years later, some other investors, namely a lot of white-owned, but there were many other, some black-owned, and some Latin-owned and Oriental-owned mortgage companies came and bought these houses in groups of 10, 15, and 20 for 20 and 30 cents on the dollar. Okay, this is an economy that makes profits on everything, but it's called a search and destroy, is what I call it, a search and destroy economy. Okay, these were single-family home loans, private companies. Who knows? I don't know. I do know, but it would take me an hour to answer the question. What I'm saying is they were all private investors who were heavy political campaign donors who kicked the money back to the politicians who kept the whole thing going. Now, they won't tell you that. Now, I caught CIA, I became a witness to CIA dealing drugs more than 24 years ago. I come from a CIA family. I worked for LAPD. I didn't discover this because I was an LA cop. It's not something every LA cop knows. It happened because I come from a CIA family, and my mother was a cryptographer for the Tehran conference in 1943 with Franklin Roosevelt. Okay, I was being groomed to be a CIA agent or officer within LAPD. Now, I never worked for the agency, but I met a lot of agency people inside LAPD who carried badges and guns, but they were CIA more than they were LAPD cops. And that's the way the agency protects its drug trafficking. Okay. Now, I was forced out of LAPD in 1978, years before the Contras, but I had seen it firsthand that I was shot at, and I won't bore you with all the details. They weren't boring at the time, but I won't go through that now. What I'm saying is that there's a great many of us who know there are people in a court of law, eyewitnesses. The first thing a DA asks for, did anybody witness the crime? Well, I'm an eyewitness to CIA dealing drugs, and so is Selly. We're the first people you would want to talk to, but we've been ignored. But I want to talk about an issue of proof. People say there's no proof. And I'm going to tell you right now, we have so much proof that before a jury of any rational men and women anywhere in this country, we could prove right now that the CIA is criminally complicit in the drug trade. I'm going to talk to you just a little bit about that. You all remember the Gary Webb stories from 1996 about Freeway Ricky Ross, the Dark Alliance series, which brought CIA Director John Deutsch to Locke High School so I could beat up on him for a little while. That was fun. And the big investigations that came as a result of that. That's Gary Webb's fabulous book, Dark Alliance, which goes further than any other toward really documenting direct CIA involvement. Well, a number of investigations were started as a result of that. And as a result of my confrontation with John Deutsch. Now, these are excerpts which I publish, but the report from which these excerpts come is a CIA report. And I have a huge website, and those of you who want to write it down, it's www.copvcia.com, C-O-P-V-C-I-A.com. And you can link directly to the CIA report, which is about 460 pages. But I have pulled these 60 pages out of that report, and I've made my editorial comments, but these are the CIA's own words. In their report, which was released on October the 8th of 1998, the CIA admits that it, throughout the course of the Contra War, it dealt with 58 known narcotics traffickers. It admits that it kept six of them out of jail. It admits that it deliberately lied to the United States Congress about the role of drug trafficking played by its assets and employees during the Contra War. It admits that it briefed Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush on how it was lying to Congress about trafficking by its agents and employees and assets on a regular basis, and that Vice President Bush approved. It admits page after page after page, but let me just read you one little example, okay, when we talk about proof. Paragraph 490, and I've got about 3-4 minutes left. How am I doing on time, all right? Paragraph 490 talks about a guy named Moises Nunez, okay? He was a CIA contractor, in essence. He was on a State Department subsidy. The poor guy wasn't making enough moving 200 kilos of cocaine a week, so the State Department had to give him a little extra to supply humanitarian aid to the Contras. And he was caught with 200 kilos of cocaine and taken into custody, and the CIA talked to him, and they wrote here, he says that Nunez revealed that since 1985 he had engaged in a clandestine relationship with the National Security Council. That's the White House that oversees the CIA. That's Oliver North, okay? He had engaged in a clandestine relationship with the National Security Council. Nunez refused to elaborate on the nature of these actions but indicated it was difficult to answer questions relating to his involvement in narcotics trafficking because of the specific tasks he had performed at the direction of the NSC. In other words, he's dealing the cocaine for the White House. It's right here, CIA's own report. Okay? In the next paragraph, CIA says, well, we didn't know what to do with this guy, but it says, the next day, however, a headquarters cable stated that headquarters had decided against debriefing Nunez. Don't ask him any more questions. Direct cable from CIA to the field. Page after page, a company called Setco, moving 4 tons of cocaine a month, owned by Juan Ramon Maraballesteros in Honduras, was using bank accounts that were opened by Oliver North. It's right here in the CIA's report. Now, let me read you the most stunning part of this. This is the actual letter. It's a memorandum. In 1981, Ronald Reagan's Director of Central Intelligence and the U.S. Department of Justice began a series of negotiations because it's a law under U.S. code that a government agency must report crimes by its employees. But yet they started a whole new series of negotiations under Reagan, and they suddenly took, at CIA, the highest food level on the food chain is a case officer. That's a card-carrying, badge-carrying CIA guy who can't be disavowed if he's caught or captured. Beneath that, they have career agents, they have contract agents, they have informants, they have contract employees, they have all these other things. And they entered into this negotiations, and they suddenly said, everybody who's not a case officer at CIA is no longer an employee under the law. These are people who were going to get pensions from CIA. Let me read you this letter dated, just one paragraph, dated February 11th, 1982. It's addressed to the Honorable William J. Casey, Director of Central Intelligence, signed by William French Smith, Ronald Reagan's Attorney General. It says, in light of these provisions and in view of the fine cooperation the Drug Enforcement Administration, Sally may comment on that, has received from CIA, no formal requirement regarding the reporting of narcotics violations has been included in these procedures. By the stroke of a pen, this is the smoking gun document, the U.S. Department of Justice told the CIA that there was no need to report drug trafficking by its employees. Now, if I say to you that we have a criminal government, maybe I will make some sense to you. I hope so. It's clear. It's as clear as the nose on my face. It's as clear as the nose on everybody's face right here, okay? We have a criminal government that is engaged in criminal activity. So why do we question the... Why do we act sometimes as if we're dealing with someone that has perfect legitimacy, but we have to work within the system? We have now enough evidence, and I think Bill will probably agree with me, he's a good lawyer, we could put the CIA on trial right now and convict them beyond a shadow of a doubt. I would like to take it to a jury, and I think you would too. Okay, but even more so, the United States Congress in May of this year, after 4 years of stalling, after they sent investigators from the House Intelligence Committee to copy 6,000 pages of my records, said, we've looked at all the evidence, including what I just read you, and said there's no evidence that CIA had anything to do with drugs, case closed. That's the House Intelligence Committee. They read what I just read you and hundreds and thousands of pages more and said there's nothing wrong here. And yet, just 2 weeks ago, the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, that's one level below the Supreme Court, and hearing the case of a Contra leader, Renato Pena, who was fighting extradition, said, we've read these same documents, and Mr. Pena is making a claim that the CIA sanctioned his drug trafficking, and we think he's right. He needs an evidentiary hearing. So that's pending, but our case just got very strong. Stronger. Now, I want to show you a couple more things before I turn this over to Bill. I've been at this for 22 years, and I have collected lots of documents. And again, my website is huge, and if you're interested, please go visit us on the web. If you want current stuff that's really hot and new, please subscribe to From the Wilderness, because the subscribers get the stuff that's new. I have to toot my own horn. Is that okay? He says he does it all the time anyway. If you can see the headline on this story, it's called The Democratic Party Presidential Drug Money Pipeline. I wrote this in the April issue of From the Wilderness. It has been nominated for a $20,000 prize at the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, D.C. In this article, I document how Charles Manatt, the former Democratic National Committee chairman, with Tony Coelho, has established a drug money pipeline going directly into the Gore presidential campaign. And it was done through the Dominican Republic, where Charles Manatt is now the U.S. ambassador to the Dominican Republic, which is a backwater posting for anybody in the State Department. And in fact, no political appointee has ever taken the position as ambassador to the Dominican Republic since 1957. Yet just last December, Charles Manatt, one of the most powerful lawyers in the world, a former DNC chair, voluntarily became ambassador to the Dominican Republic. And then I produced a sensitive, classified intelligence report out of the Department of Justice saying that one-third of all the cocaine entering the U.S. passes through the Dominican Republic. They don't tell you that in the major media, do they? Then I documented how Coelho and Manatt had in the 80s been tied to a drug smuggler named Barry Seal. And I also tied in this article the fact that the Dominican Revolutionary Party, which is headquartered, of course, in the Dominican Republic in Washington Heights of New York City, had made direct cash contributions to Al Gore in 1996. If you don't play with drug money in this economy, you can't play at all. And until you understand that, you don't understand how it all works. And that's why I say over and over again, the way to pull the plug on the whole rotten system is to decriminalize. It worked with Al Capone, didn't it? It put the bootleggers out of business, didn't it? Why are we so afraid to touch that subject now? Well, I'm going to shut up in a second, and I'm going to invite you down up. I just want to say that I took this evidence right here, and I said last in 1998, we don't need anything else other than what's in this report to sue the government. And maybe Bill Simpich will tell us a little bit about what happened next. Thank you.
You get a round of applause. Just a couple points right quick. One, Mike Rupert is constantly living hand to mouth.
And the reason why he's so committed to this cause, that many times we ask him to come to speak to different communities, like the Nation of Islam's mosque, or ask him to come to speak to the students at Santa Monica College or Cal Berkeley. Even when they have no money, he will come and give this information, come out of his own pocket to get there. And that's commitment. So I'd like to give a round of applause to a real warrior for this cause. Also, the struggle against the CIA and drugs is not a new struggle. We can go back to the 1930s with the Nation of Islam and Malcolm X, who, if you remember any of Malcolm's speeches, talked about the role of the government bringing heroin into Harlem, because how many, you know, black people have planes and have contacts in, you know, Burma, Laos, and these kind of areas. We can look at the Black Panther Party. We can look at SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, under Marion Barry, under Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael, who constantly put out educational materials about how the drugs got into our communities. We can look at the Black Panther Party and brochures being put out on how do drugs get in our community. We can look at the Chrisick's Institute in 1984. That was a vanguard organization that brought to our consciousness the role of the CIA bringing drugs in our community. We can look to the crack of CIA code. So there's a whole history of struggle to bring to the forefront the question of CIA and drugs. I like to say that the CIA is like roaches, you know, and I don't know how many people have roaches in their homes, but if you got roaches in your home, you know, if you put a light on them at night, they scurry away. And because of the excellent work of the panelists and of these mass movements, like the Nation of Islam, like the Black Panther Party, like the Chrisick's Institute, like Students for a Democratic Society, and today because of the Crack the CIA Coalition, among other groups, that we find the quantity and quality of cocaine in our community radically declining compared to what it was like from 1982 to 1994. So we, the progressive community, should take responsibility and take pride in the victory in rolling back the cocaine epidemic in third world communities. Because it wasn't the government that stopped the flow of cocaine in our community. It was the mass protests and the educational campaigns and the works of people on this panel that rolled back the epidemic that terrorized our community and many communities from 1982 to 1994. So without further ado, I'd like to bring up Bill Sippage. He does this work pro bono. He leads the legal team of Commissari, Furwich, and Sippage that has taken on the task of utilizing the legal system to indict the CIA and to get reparations through a class action lawsuit. And, you know, lawyers tend to be a very conservative lot. And, you know, when you go as a legal firm, a small legal firm against the mighty CIA, that's the spirit of Malcolm X. That's the spirit of Cesar Chavez. So as a lawyer taking that kind of stand, I've got the highest respect because, you know, they're in the bullseye, the crosshairs of the CIA right now. So can we give a round of applause to Bill Sippage and the excellent work he's doing?
Thank you, Dedan. And Mike stole my line because we're in a time where we've got to move into an investigation-free zone. The investigation, in other words, has been done. Dedan laid it out, Mike laid it out, and Sally's going to lay it out. So I'm only going to focus on a couple pieces of evidence, and I'm going to urge that people read some of these books if they haven't read them already, but don't go out there feeling like there's more that needs to be uncovered. What the difference is, in short, we need to take action. We need to take serious, fundamental, mass action. And that action has to focus on many issues, but one of them has got to be ending the drug war. And to end the drug war, a fundamental piece of it has got to be to focus that light, that spotlight, on the CIA and these other intelligence agencies that are running their schemes around the world and say very clearly, no more, not in our name. Because reading is important and research is important. I don't want to denigrate those things. But they can't be a substitute for action. And we on the legal team and those of us who are plaintiffs, like Donna Warren, who is the lead plaintiff in the case and has put in many, many, many hours of her own without pay. None of us can do the work effectively if there aren't people pushing the system on a daily basis. In the schools, in their communities, at their labor unions, this issue has to be raised over and over again until the paranoia goes away.